Well, for some of you who are just a little too young to know about the Betty and Barney Hill case, they were abducted back in their hometown state of New Hampshire a long time ago, and it turned out to be one of the most incredible abduction stories and cases you'll ever hear. When we come back with Kathleen Martin and Stanton Friedman and talk about their new work, Science Was Wrong, and then later on you'll get a chance to chat with them too on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Stanton Friedman, Kathleen Martin. Kathleen, give us an overview of Science Was Wrong.
Well, Science Was Wrong is a book that Stan and I wrote about startling truths about cures, theories, and inventions that they declared impossible. And they is, in many cases, the scientific establishment. And what we do is we explore the reasons for this. In 14 chapters, we each wrote 7 chapters, and the book is divided into a number of different sections, 5 different sections. Stan wrote about aerospace, technology. I wrote 3 chapters on medicine. We both wrote about politics. I wrote 2 chapters there, and he wrote 1, global warming, man or nature. And then we have a last section called The Frontiers of Science, in which I explored psi phenomena and the conundrum of alien abduction, and Stan wrote about UFOs. So we have a variety of topics on different issues, but in each case, something went wrong. And these subjects were debunked. They weren't accepted by the scientific establishment, often for political reasons or as a result of greed or egos, and sometimes religion even got in the way.
You both hold science in a high regard. So you're not poking at science, are you?
No, we're not at all.
No.
We are actually exploring the reasons why science sometimes fails. In the long run, in all of our chapters, there was a happy ending that these new, very sound scientific discoveries were eventually accepted. But the unfortunate part is that the denial of this good scientific work by the scientific establishment held up progress. And in some cases, hundreds, if not thousands, of people died as a result.
Stan, let's bring up cold fusion at this point as an example. You've got your very tough views on cold fusion. How does science react to that?
Well, I haven't heard many things back from science about that one yet. I'm waiting. The fact of the matter is that, yes, it was badly handled when it was first put out by Pons and Fleischmann, a big public announcement instead of an article in a scientific journal. That automatically turned an awful lot of people off. It was not directly reproducible all the time. They had this remarkable claim that you could take, call it a magic bottle, that had heavy water, curium oxide, and palladium, a fairly dense, peculiar metal, and by running a current through this device, you'd get more energy out than you put in, with the implication being that nuclear fusion was going on inside the palladium, where the heavy water, the deuterium, heavy hydrogen, was locked in, so to speak. Palladium is a great thing for absorbing an enormous amount of hydrogen. And so the noise went out. Some people tried a quick reproduction. There wasn't a scientific article to refer to, unfortunately. And it got blasted from all directions. Now, fortunately, there were some people who found that, they did get an effect. There was some energy coming off there. Now, the kicker here was, the notion was that nuclear fusion, which is what goes on in the sun and all the stars, has to involve very high temperatures and pressures. And, you know, how could you have a little device sitting on your desk that produced energy from nuclear fusion? There weren't any high temperatures or anything like that. So it seemed intuitively to be obvious that this couldn't be real. despite the fact that the measurements in some cases indicated it was. So it went through ups and downs. These guys got hounded out. Pons and Fleischmann both got basically hounded out of their jobs. And fortunately, there were some people like the Navy, like the Electric Power Research Institute, like Toyota, who looked at this stuff and said, you know, why don't we look at this more carefully? And when they did, they began to get good results, too. And so as time went on, the percentage of experiments in which there was a net production of energy grew and grew. But that didn't stop the nasty, noisy negativist, I can use the same phrase here as I do in the UFO world, from attacking. Remember, the basic rules for debunkers of anything are, don't bother me with the facts, my mind's made up, I've taken a stand and I'm not going to change, you know. And the second, of course, is what the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. For example, if you have fusion reactions going on, even at these low temperatures, there ought to be neutrons produced. And the question is, are there or aren't there? Well, it turns out there have been several papers published saying, indeed, there are neutrons produced. And there's a whole bunch of these other things that went on that turned out to be, in spite of the noisy negatives, to be true. So I anticipate this is an area where we're going to hear a lot more. And people need to recall that it takes an enormous amount of time, money, effort to go from, you know, tabletop devices to major facilities. I shocked somebody the other day when I said the Manhattan Project to develop nuclear weapons cost $2 billion in 1942 money. And, you know, that's an enormous amount of money. So you can't say, oh, I got a good idea. Let's go down the basement. We'll build something and next month we'll sell it. That's not how it works when you've got really new technology. And heavy water is expensive and palladium is expensive. So you don't do experiments very easily. But some of the attacks were really stinko science, if I can coin a phrase. And I want other people to be looking at this. As a matter of fact, the SSE Journal has a whole issue in recent months devoted to low-energy nuclear reactions. That sounds much better than cold fusion.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit of your relationship with Carl Sagan.
Well, it's kind of strange. I grew up in Linden, New Jersey. He grew up in the next-door town, Rahway, New Jersey. We didn't know each other then, but these were, you know, we played football. Our schools played football against each other, and so we're the same age. I'm 4 months older, I guess. And we met one time at a summer camp while we were still in high school. Anyway, I went to the University of Chicago in 1953, and he was already there. Chicago was strange at that time. They took kids right out of high school. Huh. You could do 2 years of high school and then go over to the college of the University of Chicago.
And you're ready to go. Okay.
Yeah, get an early start. So if it just turns out that for 3 years we were in essentially all the same classes in the physics department at the University of Chicago. We suffered through some of the same poor professors and some of the same good professors. Chicago was going through a transition then, too. and so we got to know each other quite well at that time. And we've had contact since then. I mean, Carl died, of course, in the 90s, but I was at his home less than 2 years before that, and I spoke at Cornell University a couple of times. And the last time, I was sponsored by the UFO Club, whose advisor was a professor of astronomy in Carl's department. So when I came to town, that professor picked me up, and we went over to Carl's house and had cookies and coffee and so forth, and it was all quite cordial and friendly, and it was good to see him. He was mystified to some extent, I think. He knew my background. We were in classes together, and, you know, how could I come down on the pro-UFO side, so to speak? And actually, I've been fairly strong in my criticisms of some of the things he's written about UFOs in his books and statements he's made on television and a an article in a Sunday supplement. Kathy, remember the name of that supplement?
Yes, Parade.
Parade, that's right.
Parade,
and,
sure.
You know, High Circulation magazine had an article about abductions focusing on the Hill case and got it all wrong. And this came out after he and I had this last meeting. And as a matter of fact, he sent me a copy, an advance copy, and I wrote a long, detailed critique of the article. He didn't pay any attention to that, but we had some more conversation. I was challenging him to a debate, but then I heard he was suffering from cancer, and I certainly stopped pushing him. He had other problems to worry about. But I have to give Carl credit for something. He did more than anybody else that I'm aware of, anyway, to get people interested in the whole notion of extraterrestrial intelligence. You know, there being life out there.
Well, and he was a believer that it was out there, right?
Yes, very definitely. And it's interesting that I mentioned that Bryce Zabel and I will be talking in Roswell about this new movie, Magic Men. Well, Bryce did Dark Skies, and in one of the last episodes, there was a character, Carl Sagan, who had been read in early on the truth about flying saucers with the agreement that he would always debunk.
Hmm.
Now, that goes back to the late 90s, mind you.
Well, then, let me bring Kathleen in for a second here with this story. Kathleen, of all the chapters in this book, Science Was Wrong, you seem to really have a passion for the title, The Eugenics Movement in America. Tell me why.
When I was in college, I was studying psychology and sociology, social work, and in these classes, we were still discussing eugenics. It wasn't termed eugenics at that point, and that also came into a genetics course that I took, where the discussion was whether or not we should be sterilizing mentally retarded people, mentally ill people. In some states, it was still legal to force sterilizations on these people. And even in a genetics class, we talked about a study that was done that indicated that the sons of convicted felons often became convicted felons themselves. And it was believed that perhaps this was a genetic trait that was carried on in the eugenics movement. It was called germplasm. It wasn't called genetics, and that this trait could be eliminated by sterilizing the sons of convicted felons and the convicted felons themselves. And it was quite a hot topic when I was in college, and when I think about all of this, and the more I have researched the eugenics movement, I find that it was so extensive that many of the people in my life would not have been here. I have a cousin who is deaf, and Stan has a daughter who is deaf. They're both college-educated, productive members of society. Had the eugenics movement succeeded, there's a good chance that they would not have been here. And if they still were, they both would have been sterilized. And probably all of the members of my family would have been sterilized because one deaf person was born into our family. So this really hits home with me.
Well, it's
also,
so, it's
when
so
you think about Dan's family coming from Lithuania, and the Hitler's regime in Eastern Europe, the members of his family who were exterminated by Hitler really drives home a point to me. And so I am very passionate about this.
Tell me a little bit, Kathleen, because of your experience with Betty Hill, of what you wrote about the conundrum of alien abduction. Tell me about that in the variety of disorders that some people try to associate with that.
Yes. In the conundrum of alien abduction, I examined the academic studies that have been done in an attempt to explain why some people believe they've been abducted when allegedly they have not. And the thing that really interested me in the beginning is where this whole notion came from, that we're going to fund sociological studies instead of funding physical science studies of UFO evidence. And it took me back to the Condon Committee. And I started to explore this, and I found that of the 7-member committee, there were 4 psychologists. There was 1 physicist, and that was Edward Condon, but we know that Condon took a negative view of UFOs in general, that he tended to focus on the lunatic fringe and really didn't take a serious look at the whole, all of the UFO evidence.
And I think that was a setup from the get-go, don't you, Stan?
Well, it seems to have been. Somebody had to do something because of all the fuss about, the Michigan cases, as a matter of fact, swamp gas and all that sort of stuff, and more sightings come into play. So we got to do something, folks, to get the press and everybody else convinced that there's nothing to this, and we got to find somebody who take the right attitude, quotes, and they found Condon. And it was hard to find somebody who would take on the study. There was quite a bit of money. Wound up spending $539,000, which for an academic institution is quite a bit. But their attitude was known right from the beginning, and Kathy has quoted in her in various places the memo that was written. Maybe people remember it from Look magazine. What was that? The trick has to be what, Kathy? You tell them.
Well, it is the trick memo. And I wanted to mention that one of the committee members was the assistant dean of the graduate school, Robert Lowe. He was the project coordinator. And to me, this is very important because he wrote that it is not acceptable to study UFOs, that this would be sort of an embarrassment to the college. And the trick would be to describe the project so that to the public it would appear to be a totally objective study, but to the scientific community would present the image of a group of non-believers trying their best to be objective but having almost zero expectation of finding a saucer. And he went on to write, "I can quite easily imagine, however, that psychologists, sociologists, and psychiatrists might well generate scholarly publications as a result of their investigations of saucer observers." And so it appears to me that this is the beginning of the shift from the academic study, the funding of projects to look at UFO evidence, such as Dr. James McDonald did, onto funding social science research projects to study not the evidence, but those who report observing UFOs.
Is it safe to say that science, like the pandemic they claimed with the swine flu, was so wrong that it has disastrous effects?
Well, there's a couple of chapters in the book. One of my favorite people, Ignaz Semmelweis.
Let's talk about Ignaz when we come back. Okay, we're going to take your phone calls next hour with Kathleen and also with Stanton. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about science was wrong on Coast to Coast AM. Stan, right before the break, you were telling us about one of your favorite portions of the book.
Yeah, about Ignaz Semmelweis. Kathy wrote the chapter. I had dug out the original story, which fascinated me. And here's a perfect example of a guy who figured out the science, figured out what was going on, but was kicked out of the hospital. Kathy, why don't you tell the story?
Okay. Ignaz Semmelweis lived from 1818 to 1865. He grew up in Pest in Hungary and then went on to medical school at the Vienna General, in Vienna, and taught medical students at the Vienna General Hospital. And at that time, the lying-in unit at the General Hospital had been divided into two sections. This was the largest teaching hospital in Europe. One section was for teaching medical students, while the other was for teaching midwives. The idea of introducing medical students into the specialty of obstetrics was fairly new at that time. And there was a problem in the hospital where rows of women would often become infected, and up to 2 weeks after childbirth, it was typically an infection in the uterus or the genital tract, and it became a systemic infection within hours. And the death rate was very, very high. And not only the women, but their infants also succumbed to this. It was a real problem in the medical hospitals throughout Europe. And by accident, really, Ignaz Semmelweis discovered that the contaminants that were causing this were brought on the hands of his students and himself, actually, from the mortuary, where they did the dissections in the morning, into the lying-in unit in the afternoon, where these medical students would do internal examinations on these women. And often the exams were rough. They were inexperienced students. And women were subjected to several internal examinations over the course of the afternoon. Nobody washed their hands. Nobody realized that this bacterium, it was actually Streptococcus,
which they could never see, right?
Which they could not see, was carried on these medical students' hands. Semmelweis had a friend who was actually pricked by a scalpel during one of these dissections and became infected and ended up dying as a result of this infection. And his symptoms were exactly the same as the symptoms of all of these women and infants who had died. And Semmelweis introduced the very simple method of hand washing. He used lime water and insisted that all of his medical students, instead of simply wiping their hands on their bloody aprons before they did internal examinations, would wash their hands. As a result of this, Semmelweis ended up losing his job. He wrote about this. He did very good scientific recording of his results. He used good scientific protocols in doing laboratory experiments.
Why'd they dump him?
He wasn't playing the game the way he was supposed to.
The medical establishment throughout Europe was not willing to accept the idea that his theory was correct. They adhered to the milk metastasis theory that said that women were plumbed sort of incorrectly, and that the milk from their breast moved down into their uterus instead of operating the way that it should. And they thought that the pus that they found inside of these women was actually milk. There was the miasma theory, where they thought that it was putrid matter from swamps that was affecting these women and killing these women, and that there was absolutely nothing that they could do about it. The doctors at the time certainly didn't want to admit that their own hands, which were supposed to be healing these women, were actually killing them. And Dr. Semmelweis was called a charlatan. He was debunked throughout Europe for his entire lifetime. His theory was not accepted.
Now, Stan, you give me some examples. As you say, astronomers sometimes are the target in Science Was Wrong.
Well, yeah. Yeah, and I, for good reason. Astronomers have taken, because they deal with the universe, and our concept of the universe has changed drastically over the last 100 years, less than that. They have spoken out and stood in the way of progress. The greatest astronomer, American astronomer of the 19th century, Simon Newcomb, made a strong statement in 1903, October, and the date's important, that all the evidence had shown that there would never be possible to fly a vehicle. That may be a balloon, but not a vehicle. This is 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight.
Yeah.
And there were on the other end, in 1956, a year before Sputnik, the British Astronomer Royal said that space travel is utter bilge. Nobody would spend the money, and it wouldn't be a sensible thing to do. And we should develop better instrumentation for astronomy. And yet the crazy thing is that astronomers have benefited more than any other group of scientists from the space program.
Absolutely. Hubble. Let's note the Hubble, right?
Yeah, and the Kepler and the Chandra and there's a whole bunch of others. And it's truly remarkable that we have to remember here. Astronomers know nothing about advanced flight technology, space technology. They're not the guys who design the rockets or anything like that. And there's a long history of massive misunderstanding. My favorite, I have to tell you this. In 1941, a Canadian astronomer, Dr. Campbell, was sick and tired of all this science fiction stuff about going to the moon, you know, the pulp magazines and stuff. He was going to show that this made no sense. And so he did show that. He did a paper published in a scientific journal calculating the initial launch weight of a rocket able to get a man to the moon and back. Legitimate question. How big does the darn thing have to be? Bottom line, it would have to weigh 1,000,000 tons. Even for me, that's too big. Funny thing, 1969, still with a dumb old chemical rocket, we sent three guys to the moon and back. The initial launch weight of the rocket was 3,000 tons. He was off a factor of 300 million. Now, you talk about being wrong, because he didn't know anything about space travel. He hadn't studied the publications that were readily available to him. He assumed a single-stage rocket, too low a limit on acceleration, too low a limit on velocity of the stuff coming out the back end, assumed you had to provide all the energy, didn't seem to know anything about cosmic freeloading, as I call it. And so if you make enough stupid assumptions, you can come up with wrong conclusions. That's the basic notion there. And there are many other examples, but astronomers also try to pretend that they're experts on human behavior. Now, if you were listing experts on, on alien behavior, worse than that, experts on human behavior, astronomers would not rank high on your list of people, sociologists, psychiatrists, psychologists, maybe even lawyers, but astronomers? And yet they're going to tell us that aliens, if they were coming here, would contact us. They would have sent messages first, and a whole bunch of other things, which make no sense. There would be no secrecy, as if every country wouldn't love to get its mitt on a flying saucer, of course, for military applications. So, yeah, they're the villains in my half of the book.
Hey, Stan, I wanted to get your take, too. Joseph Farrell says that in Roswell, that whatever crashed was Nazi technology, and that they crashed it here. What do you think of that?
Well, I wrote my monthly column for the MUFON Journal is about Farrell's book. It's over 500 pages. I did read the book, and he mentions me very often and quotes at great length my stuff. But he's basically wrong, as far as I can tell. He ignores the testimony of the witnesses involved with Roswell, and we are asked to believe that this was developed in Nazi Germany. The war ended in 45. It wasn't used during the war. There's no question about that. And then suddenly they moved to Argentina, and they were flying these things to do reconnaissance in the United States. For what reason, I don't know. He doesn't give any. And how could they have developed it and not used it? And again, going back to money, it takes a lot of dough to develop new flight technology and to build a whole bunch of these things. We're not talking about one. You know, we can't say there was a crash at Roswell and that was Nazi, but everything else was something else. That makes no sense.
No.
So I don't buy it. I said so in my review. I'm waiting to hear from somebody saying, you're full of baloney. That'll happen.
And Kathleen, with you and your work with Captured, along with Stan.
Yes.
In your opinion, after everything you reviewed, what do you think happened to Betty and Barney Hill?
I think that Betty and Barney actually did have a close encounter with an unconventional flying object in New Hampshire's White Mountains. I know from the original report and from being there in the very beginning, being at their house within 2 days, from the descriptions that Betty and Barney gave to my parents, that they had conscious recollection of seeing this craft at less than 100 feet, hovering less than 100 feet silently above their vehicle. This was clearly an unconventional aircraft. Barney had conscious recollection of observing non-human entities in this vehicle in the field. He was greatly frightened by this. Something started to drop down out of the bottom of the craft. He was afraid he was going to be captured. They had conscious recollection of two series of beeping or buzzing sounds on the trunk of the vehicle as they sped down Route 3 in New Hampshire, the major north-south route in 1961, the craft in pursuit. This beeping and buzzing sound caused the car to vibrate, and it caused this feeling of a tingling feeling to pass through Betty's and Barney's bodies and cause them to feel sleepy. An important point here is that they had a period of what was called doorway amnesia at the time. They had full conscious recollection of the sounds on the trunk of the car, of Betty rolling down the window to look up to see if she could see this thing. And then the next thing they knew, they were 35 miles down the road. They hadn't spoken to each other. They had no recollection of what happened during that period of time for those 35 miles. And when they arrived home, there was physical evidence that something bizarre had happened to them. I believe that they did have a real abduction. Perhaps it wasn't identical to all of Betty's memories under hypnosis, because some of her memories were very similar to her dreams. However, there was information that both Betty and Barney gave independently, and there's no way that they could have shared that information with each other. And that information leads me to believe that they were abducted. In my comparative analysis, I looked at statements that Betty and Marty independently made about the number of beings that might have been standing in a certain location, about their behavior, about their movements, about the sequential order in which things happened. And none of this was in Betty's infamous dream material. So, and what I found was statistical evidence, correlating data, that told me that at least part of this abduction has scientific backing, that there is scientific evidence in the form of social science that indicates to me this was a real experience. In addition to that physical evidence, I think that the tearing in Betty's dress is very, very significant. It isn't often emphasized. We talk about the pink powdery substance in Betty's dress. But when she arrived home, that dress that was a fairly new dress that she had worn, she spent the day seated in the passenger side of the vehicle. And when she arrived home, the zipper was torn at the top. The zipper fabric was torn 1 inch on one side and 2 inches on the other side. The dress was in fine condition when she put it on in the morning. When she took it off the following morning, it was torn. It was torn from waist to hemline. Well, possibly the lining could have become torn during the day. But that doesn't explain how the hem was torn down on that side of the dress, too. That indicates that some kind of struggle probably took place. And then we have to look at the tops of Barney's shoes. They were deeply scraped. They were so scraped that he, even though they were his dress shoes, he was never able to wear them for that purpose again.
Scraped or cut?
They were scraped. They were scraped. And he had to wear them for yard work after that. It was more than just being scuffed. They were scraped. And I have that in Barney's words.
Oh, what's the significance of that, Kate?
He was a very careful dresser.
It means that he was dragged. And under hypnosis, he talked about being dragged. He described the sensation.
See, now that doesn't sound alien, does it, Stan? Because every case we hear, they're kind of fluided, aren't they?
Well, in this case, being on one side, being on the other side, Barney's eyes were closed. Remember, Barney had a gun. He was much more of a threat to them than Betty was. And so they physically removed him, and maybe they got smarter later on, you know. But there was no instance in this story, anyway, of them going through a wall or a window or anything like that. If you got those powers, why do you need to drag somebody, you know? But
I want to
add
information here, too, that he, although his toes were bouncing along the rocks, and I used the word dragged, his arms were out, and he did have a floating sensation. So it appears he was being escorted, but his feet were dragging.
Ah, okay. And that makes sense. Well, you two both stay with us. We're going to come back and take phone calls with you. Our two special guests tonight, Kathleen Martin, Stanton Friedman, we're talking about two of their works, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, and Science Was Wrong. So we'll open up your phone lines in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM when we come back right at the top. Stanton's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. It's stantonfriedman.com. And Kathleen Martin's website, there's a dash between Kathleen and Martin, MARDEN.com.